Hi, welcome to Light Camera Author. I'm Jim Juno, and I have with me tonight an author. Her name is Madeline Boccaro, and she has a book out. It is entitled, if I can get the words out, it's entitled In Your Mind, The Infinite Universe of Yoko Ono. And it's self-published, and you can and well, Madeline, tell me, welcome to the show, first of all.
Thank you so much.
Now, this is a self-published book, so can you tell me what is the best way for people to order the book right off
So
the bat?
right off the bat, here's the cover. It's on Amazon, and that's probably your best bet international shipping wise. But this hardcover version is only available through me, and you can have it signed as well. And that's only at conceptualbooks.com. And there's a website for the book with some other places you can get it, and that is inyourmindbook.com.
Fantastic. Well, I tell you what, now I can think of no other person in music history who has had, I'm going to try and use the right word here, controversial, has more things written about her, more things which were not true, but people just went with it, than Yoko Ono. And really, your book delves, you did a deep dive into her life, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I wanted to debunk all the myths. I wanted to show how much John loved her and why. And I wanted to show the difficulties she had in her childhood, the struggles she had, that people don't even know about. And this is why she bonded with John. They were both children of war, pretty much. They were both abandoned by their parents. His left him completely, and hers were very high-ranking, important people because they came from a long lineage of billionaire bankers, and they were one of the wealthiest families in all of Japan. But being that wealthy did her no good as a little child. She wanted her mother and a father, and she didn't even meet her father till she was almost 3 years old. And, she was waited on by servants who called her miss, and she had no friends. So it was a very difficult childhood that she had.
And people may not realize wartime Japan was, especially after the war, Japan was occupied by American forces, but it was in shambles after the war, wasn't it?
Right, especially Tokyo, where she was from. She had been evacuated with her siblings to a farmhouse in the suburbs, where she had to forage for food to feed them. She was picking berries off trees. She was looking up at the sky through a hole in the roof of this farmhouse. And that was the basis of all of her imaginings because her little brother was hungry. So he was crying. She said, Okay, let's imagine, what did you want to eat? And he said, Oh, I would like ice cream. So she said, Okay, what flavor? And they're imagining all these, flavors with a cherry on top. And what else do you want? And imagining became a huge part of escape for her. And also in her later years, she was always dreaming and imagining. And that's what she encouraged everyone to do.
And she still is,
Yeah.
from what I've read. Yeah. And now a lot of people, I'm gonna tread a little bit lightly here because so many things have been written about Yoko Ono that have not been true. And I know you debunked a lot of the myths in there. And it just struck me as odd that she was successful as an artist before she even met John Lennon. Was it New York where an art show where she was
In
having
London, in
London,
London.
I'm sorry, London. Yes, I mean, she was successful already, wasn't she?
She was 19 when her parents moved to America because her father got a banking job here again. And she was at Sarah Lawrence College, and the professors there could tell she was way, way above what was going on at the school. And they recommended that she seek out the avant-garde composers in Manhattan, which were John Cage, Lamont Young, all these people who were doing really strange things with sounds, because she wasn't really, she was born in 1933. So her preteen years were spent foraging for food, and then she becomes maybe 16, 17. She's not at home with a record player like us with pop records. She's just hearing Japanese music, right? No theater, kabuki theater. But she gravitated toward 12-tone composers, and she was more into sound actually than organized music. So she meets John Cage, and she meets her first husband, Toshi Ichinagi, who was working with John Cage, who was an avant-garde composer in Japan. And she toured with them, and then she started doing her performance art events and a gallery showing in New York as well.
And when she met John Lennon, or when John Lennon met her, he immediately was attracted to her because he saw talent in her. Now I'm gonna let's just jump right to the $500 question here. That did she break up the Beatles? And I already know the answer, but I want you to hear it from you.
Okay, so yeah, John saw positivity in her and intelligence in her. And Beatles were at odds with each other. Ringo was the first to leave during the White Album sessions, right? And he came back. George was going to leave during the Let It Be sessions, and he came back. But yeah, they were having their own problems. And in fact, when John told Yoko he was going to leave, she thought, wait a minute. What is he going to do while I'm doing my own work? He's not going to be preoccupied with the Beatles anymore. What's going to happen? Because she was an independent artist that needed to continue her own work. And, he turned to her and said, okay, now it's just you and me. And she literally shuddered because she didn't know what that meant. But, the first thing off the bat was pretty much they got into doing some films together, and the Two Virgins album, and the sound collage that was, and doing the Bedends for Peace for their honeymoon, and that was all her idea. It was her event, and he jumped right in with her, and she jumped right in with him, and they were in step with each other, and they carried on doing events and art and music together.
And it seems silly looking back now. I mean, I remember a statement that Paul McCartney made, like at some point, said in 50 years we're gonna laugh about how the Beatles broke up because Yoko sat on an amp. That was something that Paul McCartney had said. And looking back now, I guess the biggest difference is that John Lennon wanted her near him, didn't he?
Yes, he brought her to the sessions. He brought her to the bathroom with him. He was just he was not very well mentally at the time he met her, and maybe never, but she enabled him to function because she supported him, she understood him, and he, her, they were very similar. They nurtured each other. They were very lonely people, even within the surrounding fame that they had. People were trying to break them up constantly. People were trying to get in between them, but it was very stressful for them.
And I always thought that, well, Paul McCartney had Linda Eastman. And people say, well, Yoko Ono influenced John Lennon. She was saying all these things about how they should do the music and stuff. And I always thought Linda Eastman probably did this very same thing to Paul McCartney, but she just didn't do it in the studio.
Well, everybody has opinions, and I'm sure each of them asked their girlfriends for advice or what they thought. But I don't think Linda really spoke that much. And Yoko, she would give her opinion too, but the Beatles were the Beatles, and they
Yes.
pretty much left them to it, right? I mean, I don't think either woman had any influence other than was what was going to happen anyway.
Immediately, almost immediately, there was an instant dislike for Yoko Ono, by the fans, by the media. Unfair dislike. And it still goes on to this day. But do you think that part of it has to do with the fact that she wasn't like a blonde sweetheart? She was an Asian woman. She was a little bit older, I believe, than John Lennon. There was that Asia phobia I guess.
Who knows though? If she had been a blonde bombshell, maybe they would have been more jealous. I mean, they pulled her hair as it was. Maybe, you know, they would have scratched her. They would have. They wanted John to themselves, these fans, and whoever it was going to get some kind of flack. But the newspapers, I think, are to blame. You know, the media. They would. There's a journalist who allowed me to use an unpublished interview that she did with Yoko, which was beautiful from 1974. And she was happy that I was going to use it. And she said, I said, why didn't this get published? It's wonderful. She said, oh, they told me to dirty it up and say how she abandoned her daughter, how she hooked John onto drugs. And I just refused to do that. And I'm like, thank God she had the integrity, but other writers didn't, you
Yeah.
know, this is what was selling papers.
I don't think John needed any help getting hooked on drugs. And
No.
I mean, just my I probably made enemies out there for John Lennon fans. Okay, but so be it.
And not only that, you know, John was honest about that. Honest, John was honest about what they were doing. They were doing heroin. They had miscarriages. They weren't the greatest parents on and off at times, you know, and he admitted all his faults. And with all this truth, they were just after the truth, telling the truth all the time. There's still these misconceptions and lies being spun around them.
The bed-in, I want to say, who was it that there's an article, there was a video where a journalist or a cartoonist comes in and basically just insults from the get-go.
Al Cap,
Insults.
yeah.
Al Cap, yes, that's right. Lo Abner, artist. Just from the get-go, insults Yoko. I believe he calls her, what did he call her? He
Madame
called her
New or
Madame
something.
Wu, something like that. Yeah. And you know, and that was something she had to live with her whole life now, hasn't she?
Yeah, and we don't know the depth of it. I know that John was sent letters that said, be careful, she'll slit your throat in the night. And they were sent voodoo dolls in the shape of Yoko with pins in them. I mean, it was just beyond.
I want to get to the tragic events of December 8th, 1980. I would have thought that she would have gotten some sympathy from people, but even losing, having John Lennon shot in front of her, killed almost, killed in front of her, people still didn't like her. I mean, it was, and she really handled that with a lot of grace and strength.
She handled it all with beautifully. I mean, she was experiencing the worst thing in her life, and I guess she really just remained quiet at that time, you know. And little by little, people were more sympathetic toward her. She actually said when she went back into the office a few weeks after his death, she saw piles and piles of letters. And she said, oh my God, this is so sad. You know, John's not here to answer them all. But then a lot of those letters were for her, and a lot of them were really beautiful letters.
That's
So.
fantastic. I mean, that's great. I mean, it's, and her sculptures sit, they're still standing. I mean, there's one, I believe it, is it in Chicago? Sky Landing,
Yes.
which is beautiful. What influenced her in her sculpture?
Oh, Sky Landing?
Of Sky Landing, but overall, I mean, 'cause, I mean, she's got a unique touch to everything she does.
Yeah, everything she does is act first. It's a conceptual. Sky Landing is they're metal petals, flower petals that are reaching up toward the sky. And, you know, she just wanted everything about it, her life is the sky because that was the thing she saw through that hole in the roof. It was the only beautiful thing that was there for her every day and gave her hope. So a lot of it is based on the sky. The first thing that John fell in love with was a light tower, a lighthouse. And he said, can you build this in my garden? And she said, oh, well, it's just conceptual. You know, the house is made of light and it only exists when the light shines a certain way, whatever. And then years later, it became Imagine Peace Tower in Iceland. And it's like a memorial to John. And she also made strawberry fields in Central Park. She had, you know, countries from around the world donating indigenous seeds seeds and trees to plant there. And she creates these beautiful places and spaces for people to come and remember John, or just to contemplate their own life and future.
She's going to be 91 in a few days. I find that hard to believe because I'm of a certain age. I can remember her, like, you know, looking young, in her 40s, or young to me. But she has worked relentlessly, hasn't she, in saving John's legacy, in preserving John's legacy.
Yes, she has. Ever since the first year she started releasing the Lost Lennon tapes first, you know, she had Elliot Mintz presenting that series. And then she would do album, you know, she did the Milk and Honey album, which is supposed to be the follow-up to Double Fantasy, songs of hers and John's. And then she just kept, almost every year she gave us something, and it's continuing. This summer we're going to have a Mind Games box set. And she literally sits in the studio with the engineers and makes sure it's done correctly. She really oversees that beautifully.
And she's also given us the new Beatles song, Now and Then.
Yeah.
She gave us the two new Beatles songs, Real Love and Free as a Bird.
Right.
And these are not things that she needed to do or that she had to do. I mean, they were her own.
She saw them as an opportunity to bring them back together again, you know, after being blamed for taking them apart.
How did she handle that being blamed? I mean, it looks like she handled it with grace and style.
She did. And, you know, it got to her at times, but she actually said that all of that is like little stabs of acupuncture. And eventually it began healing her. She began to know how to deflect it, how to go around it. And that's how she became strong. Because she said, what if everybody told me I was great all my life? I might not have tried anymore. I mightn't have been the person I am now. So,
in your book, you also have a lot of her own words. Was it difficult finding all the information that you've compiled?
No, because I had it. I've loved her since I was 10 years old in 1968. And I just found that she was so wise, and she'd say these brilliant things, and I would save everything. And luckily, I saved it in chronological order, because when I wanted to go back and see, you know, I'm working about this album, I'd say, oh, she said this about this song. What was the exact quote? And I'd go to that month and that year and actually find it. So I'm probably the only person that could have done this book, because I have all this wonderful stuff saved.
Even Sean Ono Lennon, he has a blurb on your book, doesn't he?
Well, he told me, yeah. He said, thank you for caring enough to be so meticulous. So that's a really good compliment. And I knew he would love it, because his voice is throughout the book as well, because he's one of Yoko's biggest, he is her biggest fan. And he worked with her as a musician, and he knows her music inside and out. She taught him the workings of a recording studio. He wouldn't have known anything about, you know, the complexities of a mixing board or recording if it wasn't for her. John was already gone by the time he was 5 years old. So yeah, he's really supportive.
Have you heard from her? I mean, I know she doesn't do a lot of interviews or appearances now.
Yeah, she's winding it down. She's been very quiet, but she has it. I mean, of course, because she has it. Some family members have it. Her colleagues have been loving it. They're saying, I worked on some of her films, and I read the films chapter, and I can't believe I didn't even know that half of this stuff. And so Olivia Harrison recommended it on Instagram. It's now in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame library and archives. So I'm really happy. I just need it to get into the public hands a lot more. And I just need her true story to be out there, because all these people that are carrying around the hatred and it's only hurting them. They're walking around angry about something that didn't even happen, like, really based on lies.
Oh, I know, because I mean, from the research that I've done on, I was a big Beatles fan, but from the research I've done, it was more Alan Klein. Well, everything was happening when she came into the picture with the Beatles. Like you said, you had George Harrison, you had Ringo Starr, you had McCartney wanting to take over everything. You had the death of the manager. I was just looking at his name,
Brian.
Brian Epstein. Everything was happening, and the times were changing. They were no longer these four mop tops who were one cohesive band. It was four individuals who were growing into different tastes. So, and like I said, I'm sorry, I'm taking up all your time. But it was a lot of things happening. It wasn't just her coming onto
George
this.
had a triple album inside of him, which ended up being All Things Must Pass. He was waiting to get all that stuff onto a record, which he was never going to get onto the Beatles albums. If he had his own allotment of one or two songs, that would have taken him 15 years to get that whole thing out.
And nowadays, not just with John Lennon's legacy, but when in time of like, I'm wondering what you would think of the Israeli-Gaza war right now because of that's happening. But back, I believe in the early 2000s, she still had, like, she was still like protesting the war. It was. She does not want war to be happening in the world.
No, she's all about peace. She headed up that anti-fracking campaign. It's just that's their mission, and I don't know if we'll ever see it in our lifetime, but she believed that we would. I don't know that she will even, but there's a documentary called Give Peace a Song, and it's about the Bedouins, and this reporter says to John and Yoko, "Oh, we're never going to see peace in our lifetimes." But both of them so sincerely piped up and said, "Oh, but we will." They were just so innocent and, confident that they could change minds and change the world. I mean, imagine taking on the changing of the world. That's what they tried to do.
Exactly. I mean, it was them and them against the world. What was your favorite story that you found? Your personal favorite?
Well, I love the one of how they met, but that's been told a million times. But there's just so many. Just when they decided to make a record again, when after their son was born, when they finally won their fight to stay in America, thanks to their attorney Leon Wiles, there's just so many things in their life that they had to overcome. The FBI trailing them, the panning of his Sometime in New York City album and the concert that he did, which I attended, and it was fantastic, and it got panned and by all the critics, and he was devastated. Then there's his lost weekend, and then they come back together and they have the baby. It's an incredible life. And if you think about it, though, she was 33 when she met John. They were together for 12 years with an 18-month separation in between. And now she's 40 years without him. So that time they were together, it's a blip. It's a
It
little
is.
more than the time the Beatles were together. They were 10 years, right? So when you think about this huge life, 91 years, and the context of it all, it's really amazing.
91 years. That's a it's still hard to believe she's going to be 91. I believe on February 18th, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, Sunday.
And I guess do you have a you mentioned the film chapter. I was not aware that she was an actress, except for the films that she did with John Lennon.
Yeah, she's not really an actress. She did take a part in a film before she met John, just for some money. It was called Satan's Bed. It's really a crazy film. She plays this innocent victim, and she's actually pretty good in it. But no, not really an actress. She'd made films of her conceptual ideas. There's one of the Bottoms walking on a treadmill, which she felt was a very just a visual representation of movement and a geometrical picture on the screen, and it was basically a petition for peace as well, because each of those behinds belonged to a person who could either be killed in the war or protest the war. Then there was a Rape, in which a camera follows a woman relentlessly through the streets of London until she becomes panicked because the girl wasn't told exactly what was going to happen in this film, and they just relentlessly hound her and follow her, and she gets really freaked out, and it becomes a parallel of what was really happening to John and Yoko in their lives. And there's a film called Fly, in which a fly is crawling on a naked woman's body, and there's many ways to interpret that as well. But the woman laying there, just taking whatever society is throwing at her, and so she made these really deep films that were simple in a way, but you can really think about them.
One last question, real quick, is she was not the controlling person that the media made her out to be. John was she he leaned on her, didn't he?
He leaned on her. They both leaned on other people tremendously. Like, they didn't really have a handler or manager. They had Alan Klein, doing their, but Yoko built the business, right? She was in the office every day managing the Apple. She was buying property. She was building up John's finances because he wasn't really all that secure when in the 70, early 70s. So she had to do all that. And I don't know. I mean, I lost my train of thought, but no, they didn't have a manager. They didn't have a handler. They just did what they did. They didn't have a stylist. They didn't have an entourage, and they would just rely on their friends or whoever to get them what they needed. And they'd be on the phone to people. They'd be, get us a plane, get us a, and it wasn't any one person that did all this. It was just so random. And they relied heavily on, Yoko did, on astrology and psychics and advisors, because they really had nobody they could trust and nobody to lean on. And a lot of people betrayed them, betrayed their
Oh
trust as well.
yes. In your mind, is that a what's the story behind the title of the book there?
Well, all of her work is conceptual, it's to be completed in your mind. And I have a very rare indica brochure catalog from her first exhibition in London where she met John. And on one of the pages, it says, if you burn a chair, the chair in your mind is still there. It doesn't disappear. And the words in your mind were left out, and she wrote them in by hand. And I was just finishing the book and just thinking of what the title should be, and it jumped out at me, and I was like, that's it.
Fantastic. Well, the book is called In Your Mind, The Infinite Universe of Yoko Ono. The author is Madeline Beccaro. And Madeline, you can tell them again where to buy the book.
So the book is, here it is again. This is by a fabulous artist in Australia. I asked her if I could use this illustration, and she granted me the permission. Her name is Kat McGuinness, and you can get it on Amazon, and you can get it through me at conceptualbooks.com, and check the website for reviews and other interviews I've done. And that's inyourmindbook.com.
Well, fantastic. Madeline, again, thanks for being on Lights, Camera, Author tonight.
I appreciate it.